guys. Welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
John McCool. And Jonathan, we have a special guest on the line with us.
Yes.
Here on the Zoom line, which everybody knows about now.
yeah, unfortunately.
Right now it's like, now we're fighting for bandwidth right on our show. But so we've got a special guest, David Premer, on the line.
All right.
Oh, well, look, listen, everyone go nuts.
Yeah, going crazy.
Oh, yeah. Please, no, please, no. 15-minute standing ovation. That's going to happen now.
Yeah, David, on our last episode, we had to kill some live video, or actually the video side, because Zoom's getting overloaded right now. So hopefully we don't have any snags on this episode. But
It's after 5 o'clock Eastern, so everybody's probably started to
maybe they're filthy
fold
away.
Up. Yeah. And go home and do their homeschooling or whatever they have left to do.
Well, I'll tell you, my wife is a teacher and I got 3 kids. Mm-hmm. And so I work from home when I'm not with my clients. So we have pretty good internet, but I went for the highest internet that my telco offers this week. I just upgraded because everyone's online now.
Well, so to tell you a little bit about David, we're going to be talking about his upcoming book that's going to be out next week, which is To Sell the Way You Buy, A Modern Approach to Sales That Actually Works. And this should be interesting considering the times that we're in. I would say a lot of this would be very practical for people out there that are in sales, understanding, how to approach your audience kind of in a different way from, probably a point of empathy. But we're going to get into that. But David is recognized as a thought leader in the area of sales and sales leadership. He's been published in the Harvard Business Review, as well as Forbes, Entrepreneur, and Inc. magazines. From his early days tinkering with test tubes and different equations as an award-winning research scientist to leading top-performing sales teams at high-growth technology startups, David's lifelong passion for learning and execution is the foundation of his cerebral practice. And you can find him over at Cerebral Selling. We'll be posting that. So your background is in science. How did you get into sales?
By accident. I think that's the real answer. Yeah. Like everyone else, like no one really gets into sales on purpose. I mean, like as a lifelong profession, like you've been doing it for 17 years, I've been doing it for 20 years.
Yep.
So I got into sales at the turn of the dot-com boom. If you remember around 99, 2000, where everything was just exploding. And I was finishing up some graduate work in engineering at my U of T, University of Toronto here. And a bunch of tech companies were just hiring at that time. And I got a job. I ended up getting a job at IBM, but ended up not taking that job. Meaning like I signed on to join IBM and then 8 months, kind of before, I ended up just pivoting and joining a startup. And I absolutely fell in love with sales. I was a sales engineer. So shout out to sales engineers out there, basically like the functional technical product expert on the sales side.
That's right.
That's how I got my start.
Yeah.
That is, that's crazy. And once again, Jonathan, we have outpunted our coverage on our guest.
Yeah.
We have to make sure we do not go into science territory today because we will get left behind for sure. So,
have a conspiracy expert last week on our show. That was kind of interesting.
That was interesting. We have no idea what they're talking about, but hey, we'll keep drinking beer and talking to the guest.
No, look, you know what? We won't talk about molecules or atoms or anything like that.
That's right.
But, the way I kind of thought about sales, kind of getting into it as I did was almost like an engineering problem, if I can describe it like that, right? Like when I describe something like this, the person got it. And when I describe it like that, it went over their head. Or like when I said this, it pissed them off. Like everything is because of kind of cause and effect. And there is a formula, right, to how you can be successful in sales. And that's kind of where I bring that science and engineering background to my practice.
Well, before we go too deep in it, I want to drink a beer, so which means I need to open it and pour it and do the thing that we do on the show. So we'll let our guests go first. David, I think you have a beer that you brought with you.
Well, I'm representing Canada here. I got my Steam Whistle Pilsner, which was a craft brewery. It's still an independently owned brewery. It's getting bigger. It's a Pilsner. My father-in-law is Czech, home of the Pilsner, so I feel like I got to pay homage with this, but apparently it's, according to the label, the only Pilsner that still adheres to the standards of the Bavarian Purity Act of 1516. So there you go. Steam whistle.
Wow. Yeah. So the whole Purity Act thing that, that whole European kind of thing, craft beers have gone, I'll just tease this. My beer will be the exact opposite of that idea.
So there's no adherence to nothing in your beer. Is that what you're saying?
Wait till you hear the name of the beer that I'm going to bring on the show here. Uh-oh. So
yeah,
go ahead and crack it open for us.
There we go. Got a nice thick glass here.
Got the good old pint glass there.
Oh yeah.
Look at that. Like you're a pro. Looks like you've been on the show before.
There we go.
Oh man. Rookie. Nah, I'm just saying.
You do not want to do that over the keyboard and then over pour. That's for sure.
We did that last week.
We have done that on the show for sure. All right, Jonathan, I'll let you go, and then I'll bring out the crazy beer.
Okay, so last week I had an Innocent Gun. I had their Irish whiskey barrel, which was fantastic. But I can tell you from having this one, because this is one we've had in the past, this is just kind of the original bourbon barrel porter.
Oh, yeah, that was early.
This was over a year ago. But this one is much better than the one I had last week. I can tell you, since I've already had this one, I don't have to give too much detail, except for the fact that the color is so much darker than that.
Oh, wow. That's like black almost.
A beautiful, nice, thick head. ABV is, I think we're at like 7.5%, I believe.
Yeah.
So one of my favorites for sure.
Well, I'm going to bring out from 903 Brewers, which is somewhere here in Texas, because here in Texas, David, I don't know if you know this, but anything that's made in Texas has to have the shape of Texas somewhere on the packaging. Like it's just required apparently. And we even have nacho chips that are shaped like Texas. Like it's crazy. So this is 903 Breweries and it has Texas in the logo, but this is, are y'all ready for this? Like, blueberry brownie cheesecake stout.
Ooh. Oh, whoa. All right. Hold it. Okay. So start talking. I can't see it. If you go ahead and talk so I can see that.
Okay. So it's blueberry cheesecake. Hold on. Blueberry cheesecake. I'm waiting for the green thing to get around me.
I see it.
All right. Wow. So there it is. That's the thing. And it says stuffed on the other side. So I don't know what that means exactly, but here's the copy description on it. I have to put my reading glasses on because, I mean, that's like terrible, like reverse. That's a terrible place to put your copy. You can barely read it. So it's 9.2% alcohol by volume. And it says pairs with, this is good copy, by the way.
Yeah.
So it says pairs with vanilla ice cream, chocolate syrup, and loosening the belt. So
it's like a s'mores flavored beer is what you have there somehow.
Well, I actually had a s'mores flavored beer previously, but the blueberry takes it to a whole nother level. So
Sean gets all crazy with his taste, with his beer taste.
Strawberry shortcake stouts. Yep. And see. This is no head at all. Again,
It's like wine.
What was the ABV on that? What was, did you say
9.2?
Okay, 9.2. Wow.
Yeah, so David, the last episode that we just recorded, it was a 12%, so I may be a little punchy by the time this episode's over. But super dark.
Again, no head whatsoever.
No head. That's weird. So anyway, cheers, gentlemen.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Here we go. There we go. Mm. Wow. So how was yours, David?
It was good. My favorite beer, if you just said gun to your head, which beer do you want? Mm-hmm. I actually go for a Guinness. I like Guinness a lot.
Oh yeah. Mm.
You know, it's actually good calorically. It makes me feel good. It's not bubbles aren't too big. I know it's not super scientific, but I like that. But sometimes a nice clean Pilsner is kind of just what you need.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I do like that.
Yeah. Especially depending on what you're eating with it and how much you want to drink, you know, like, this one you're not going to drink a lot of.
With the cheesecake. It's like a dessert. Yeah. It's like everything. It's like a smoothie. And
yeah, it's, I mean, I picture like a cheesecake from the Cheesecake Factory with blueberry filling on top. And that's kind of honestly what it tastes like.
So I'm
and
curious.
It's filling.
Okay. So it's filling. It's good.
I think the honey that I had, the honey I had on the last show was better. Mm-hmm. But this is, again, it's one of those you wouldn't drink just like more than one of at a time. Mm. but it's kind of a cool taste. It's kind of different. It's a good dessert beer.
It's one that you can check off your,
put it in the app. Put in your craft brew
app. If you're
app
scoring points, check it off. All right.
Yeah. So I wish they would send like patches that I could like start putting these on. I guess I could save the cans and create a whole wall. That'd be a great backdrop for the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, nowadays, I gotta start over.
Everyone's doing Zoom, right? So everyone's looking for interesting backdrops nowadays.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I was playing around with some myself. Like,
show them the Fight Club, Sean.
Yeah. So this is Tyler Durden's bedroom from Fight Club.
Nice.
Work real well without the green screen when the headset and the bald head just, it's not a good look.
So, is this a Zoom feature that I don't even know about? Is there like a feature?
Yes.
Yeah, it is. There's a virtual background. You can load any image you want.
I didn't even know about David. I didn't know about this. We've been using Zoom for the last year and a half, and I didn't even know this until last week. Sean had to explain it to me.
So check this one out. This is
the Golden Girls.
Golden Girls. There you go.
Golden Girls.
Talking about cheesecake. That's what they did there.
So virtual backgrounds are kind of like all the rage right now for Zoom. They look a little weird depending on what's behind you, like how much they ghost. Mm-hmm. If you've got a plain white wall behind you, you don't even need a green screen or even just a plain tan smooth wall. They work great. So,
all right.
It's crazy. So right, well, let's talk about cerebral
selling. Hey, David, I want to mention your book coming up. So you said next Tuesday, right?
Yeah, it's coming out next Tuesday. Thankfully, we actually already shipped about 1,500 pre-order copies to organizations who want them. So the book is out there. But yeah, next Tuesday on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Indigo, wherever you buy books is when it's landing.
That's cool. Fantastic. I know that's exciting. So you used to, one thing I didn't mention prior in introducing, you were with Salesforce for a while. Salesforce as the VP of, was it the VP of sales?
Yeah, commercial sales. I mean, there's, it's a big company, so there's lots of VPs of sales. But I joined Salesforce because they acquired my company. I'm kind of a startup, B2B tech startup guy. Mm-hmm. And so over the last 20 years, I've done four tech startups, and three of them ended up getting acquired. One, which I helped start in 2008, was acquired by Salesforce in 2012. Mm-hmm. So I kind of came over there with the ship, kind of being a Salesforce customer many times. And I found myself instantaneously on the other side. So that's what I did. And by the end, I was running small business sales for the Eastern US, which was cool because I was servicing customers kind of like I was back in the startup days.
You've got the tagline, the sales professor. I love that. I think everybody that's just, to me, that's a cool tagline. Is that something that some of your customers attributed to you, or are you just like, you know what, I'm going to claim that one?
It was definitely not my invention.
Yep.
It came from like my teams and the people that I would train even before, I think from a career standpoint, not we're talking about career advice here, but the question is always, what should I do when I grow up? I always ask people that, regardless of where they're at in their career. What should I do? What do you want to do when you grow up? And part of what you have to do if you want to be, I think, emotionally fulfilled is look at the stuff that you've been doing for free, off to the side, out of the goodness of your heart, because it's the thing you love to do. And learning for me was always that thing, and teaching. Mm-hmm. And so I would always kind of impart these like little nuggets of sales wisdom, if you want to call it, to my teams. And I would do a lot of kind of internal training. And that's kind of where the term sales professor kicked off. But I also do teach sales leadership at a business school here in Canada.
Okay.
They don't call me sales professor there though.
Well, I got to say, I was looking at your website. I'm impressed. You got Daniel Pink as a quote in your book. And see, did he write the foreword or just one of the quotes?
Yeah.
It's on the cover quote, I guess.
Cover quote. Yeah. Just one of the endorsers. I actually don't have a foreword of my book.
Okay.
But, I'm a big fan of Dan Pink, and for those looking for really good book recommendations, I love To Sell as Human, one of my favorite sales books of all time, just because he manages to humanize the sales profession so much and kind of gives a really great digest of kind of where it's been, where it's going.
Yep.
And so he was definitely one of the fellows that I wanted to have on board with my project.
Yeah. And I wanted to say before I forget, David, that I wanted to introduce you to one of our past guests. So if you'll remind me after the show, but there's a podcast who he was on our podcast. We kind of did a simulcast type thing called Sales for Nerds. And I think y'all two might get along
well. I remember that.
So he does wine and sales, like we do beer and persuasion. He does wine and sales. And he was a former coder who got into sales. So I think y'all two would have a great time on a call. So we'll introduce you after the show and get you two hooked up, because that'd be a good fit for sure.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so tell us more about the book and kind of why people might want to read it. And we'll just, however you want to go, we'll ask questions, but like, why? So you say, let's pull apart the subtitle a little bit. It says a modern approach to sales that actually works. So there's a lot kind of going on there, right? So first of all, why is it a modern approach?
Yeah. So it's funny. So, I mean, the sales profession has changed so much over the last, never mind 10, 20 years since I started, but even the last 5 years, it's been primarily driven by buying behaviors and habits, right? Like people buy differently. There's so much information. There's so many solutions in every category. So the way people buy has actually changed quite a bit, but a lot of the tactics, it's funny. Like, so one of the questions I'll ask, and if you look on my website, the kind of the front tagline says, do you ever wonder why you don't like talking to salespeople? My website is geared towards salespeople, right? So I can be in a room of like 1,000 salespeople given a keynote address, and I will say, show of hands here, who here likes talking to salespeople?
Right.
And the only, in all fairness, some people, like a handful of people raise their hand, but I ask them, okay, is it more like professional curiosity? Like I'm in sales and I want to see how you do your thing. And they're like, yeah, that's it. Okay.
Yeah.
So besides that, no one likes talking to salespeople. And so this idea that now we have so much information, there's so much choice, you know, we have sometimes actually a difficult time buying, but when we close our eyes and we picture a salesperson, and this is something I take from Dan Pink's book and I talk about it in mine, when he asks people, what's the first word that comes to mind when I say sales or selling? It's like pushy, sleazy, like it's 80% negative, right? And so I kind of had that. So to full stop, people like buying stuff, but they don't like talking to salespeople. And so this idea of like a modern approach, it means that they don't like talking to the salesperson that they're picturing from like the 1960s selling them a shiny used car that was really a piece of shit. If I can say shit on the show, can I say shit on the show?
Yep. Sure.
Okay, good. So
we just have to downgrade our clean rating.
Downgrade. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be like an E.
So, E-.
So the idea is that like the way people think about sellers hasn't really changed all that much in forever. But the way people buy has changed. And so the idea behind sell the way you buy and the modern approach is to take some of these modern approaches rooted in science and empathy and execution and apply them to help, you know, to help our customers. Because it's actually hard to buy stuff, even though they don't like talking to salespeople. And so our goal is to be those modern salespeople that actually help customers.
So how do you get away from the, you know, in the book, I know you've got it, you probably offered some suggestions on salespeople, how to overcome the stigma, you know, as you just mentioned, that stigma of like what salespeople are traditionally. And I hate that. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I've been in industrial sales. I've been a sale, you know, I guess you'd call it a sales engineer for the last 17 years. So it's kind of a different, you know that from a chemical background. That industry is a little bit different because you're working, you know, I've worked with engineers most of my life. And it's a little bit different because you're there. There's an easy way to position yourself, because I try to look at it as, you know, when I'm meeting with engineers, we're always looking at solutions. We're not in there just to sell stuff. So we're looking at ways to create solutions, create value in those solutions from a technical standpoint and how we can improve their processes. Not everybody looks at it like that. So I'm assuming, you know, that's one of the things you talk about. How do you help salespeople, people that have been in sales and maybe they're not in technical sales per se? How How do you help them overcome that stigma of like, okay, salespeople are just out there, you know, looking to sell you something and people don't want to talk to them. And not only that, but people are more savvy. You know, the average consumer is certainly a whole lot more savvier today with so many resources at their disposal, with the internet, with, you know, social media, all these things that they can look at. You know, how do you overcome that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to say that, you know, the theme of the book, if I can call this, is not salespeople bad, let's fix that, right? Like it's not that. The idea is, when we think about selling the way you buy, there's two things. There's the empathetic component, which is simply put, don't use tactics that wouldn't work on you.
Right.
And being in sales for so many years, I had lots of reps and, you know, my team would come up to me and say, hey, David, I'm thinking about sending this email to this customer. Maybe they've gone dark or we're following up for a meeting. Like, what do you, can I send you the email? You let me know what you think. And they would send me the email and I would say, like, I don't know. Like, if you were the customer and you had gone dark, would you respond to you from this email?
Right.
And 80% of the time it would be like, no. I'm like, well, so then why are we doing this? Right. Mm-hmm. So there's an empathetic component of like, don't use tactics that wouldn't work on you. But actually what the book is more so about is the science and psychology of selling and buying. Mm-hmm. So as buyers, we are often not conscious of the pathways by which we make these purchasing decisions, right? From the clothes we wear, the car we drive, the beer we eat, the selects, to the technology or, you know, that we purchase, a lot of it is based on pathways that we're not conscious of. And a lot of those pathways, almost all of them are emotional, emotional pathways. So, you know, one of the things, so when we talk about like selling the way you buy, it's really understanding what those emotional pathways are so that you can architect your sales motion for maximum conversion and maximum, you know, kind of emotional resonance along that pathway. So if I were to give you like a simple example, a lot of people don't like talking to sellers because they feel like they're going to be pressured into buying something they don't want or need. And you know this, like, for example, if you go into like a, like you're in the mall and you go into a store and you're like thumbing through like on a sports jacket and a salesperson descends on you, right, from the corner of your eye and says, excuse me, sir, can I help you find something?
Yeah.
Right. What do you say?
No, I'm just looking.
I'm just looking. No, I don't know. Right. I don't want you to do your sleazy sales tricks to me. I'm putting the brakes on right now.
No, thank you. Yeah.
And so one of the reason why that happens is actually a psychological principle known as reactance. And what happens is when you feel your freedom to choose is being limited, you kind of lash out. And it's the same thing when you see a sign that says like wet paint on a wall and you see it's like shiny and a little smelly. Mm-hmm. You walk by like, what do you want to do? You want to touch that wall.
Yeah.
Right. Because the sign said I couldn't do it. And so one of the tactics and one of the approaches we talk about is in terms of modern selling is you actually make it okay for people to say no. And this is kind of like a, you know, it's not a new approach, but, you know, being more mindful of it. So for example, if the person came up to you in the store and said, excuse me, sir, can I help you find something? And look, and if you're good browsing on your own, all good, man. Like, no worries at all. You would actually be more likely, this is scientifically proven, to say, actually, you know what? I could use your help. Come over here. Mm-hmm. So this idea of like when you give someone permission to say no, it's more likely that they're going to say yes. But this is a psychological principle. A lot of salespeople over the years have been taught these quote unquote closing tactics to box customers in.
Yeah.
Is there any reason why, you know, Sean, you couldn't make a decision on this product today?
Right.
You're going to just say no because that sounds really sleazy. You're trying to box me in.
Yeah.
So this right. Would you prefer a blue or black blazer?
That's right. So I'm like, you know, so, and people are very receptive. I don't know. Do any of you guys have kids?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So when your kids, do your kids ever come to you and ask you for something like a permission to download an app or a Lyft somewhere, or they want a sugary snack, right?
Download an app all the time.
Download an app.
Yep.
I don't know about you. When my kids come to me and they're about to hit me up for something, I can tell immediately, immediately, just by the way they approach me. They're like, Dad, I'm like, the answer is no, right? Like, I get very defensive, like right away.
Yeah.
Right. And so I do believe when it comes to modern buying, buyers are very perceptive when it comes to, you know, the kind of the motions of salespeople, and they're especially defensive because they're salespeople, right? So what you need to do is disarm them by using some of these tactics that align with the way they buy.
Well, I think, yeah, it's interesting. You say that they're getting really good at detecting it. And we hear the stat all the time, like people hear 3,000 messages or 10,000, whatever the number's up to now, sales messages per day. And that number keeps going up. So of course like we're going to get good at deflecting those messages, whether they're online, in person, or whatever. So, you know, we have to figure out now as marketers, as persuaders, as salespeople, how do we get around those things in an ethical manner? And I think that's important. And everybody talks about those number of messages, but they're not talking about how that's actually making the consumer smarter as much. Mm-hmm. I remember when I used to sell, David, I've sold everything. I've sold funeral property, knives, used cars. I've done the whole thing, especially in my 20s. I sold just about everything you could sell, including encyclopedias. Crazy. So I totally get what you're saying. Like, you have to figure out, how do you get around those people's defenses that they put up, and they're getting stronger and savvier and everything else. And you do have to understand human nature. Like, people still want to buy.
Yeah,
absolutely. And they need more help. They actually need more help than ever before.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, so much information, so many choices in any category.
Tons. I mean, like, think about it. You want to go on vacation. So what do? You're like, I want to go to the Caribbean somewhere. So you go on Expedia and you start whatever, and you start the TripAdvisor, you start looking up places, highly rated places in the Caribbean, like a million places come back.
Right.
So now you're like, how am I supposed to make, you know, sense of this? Right. And mm-hmm. So there's kind of two things. What people have actually done is they've recoiled, and in studies like the Edelman Trust Barometer now tell us that, like, the thing that people trust more than anything in the world is the opinion of someone like them. So when faced with like this sea of like all these reviews, and like, I can't make sense of it, what do? I go to like a travel agent. I'm like, where should I go? You know, or when I go to buy, like, I give this example often, if I want to go buy like a sports jacket, and I don't buy one all that often, I go in the menswear store and there's like a million sports jackets. Like, I don't have time to start searching through.
Sure.
So what does the good salesperson do? They ask me questions about like, how often do you buy sports jackets? Where are you going to wear it? And then he says, okay, wait here. And he comes back with three. He's like, it's one of these. Okay. Now he fits me up. I pick the one, whatever it is. And I walk out of the store and I'm happy. Why? Like, because I bought the best sports jacket for me. Like, statistically, I probably didn't buy the best sports jacket for me. Right. But I feel good about my purchase because it was easy. Right. And I have very little regret. And so the sales, and this is, I'm quoting this, but this is actually not my study. This is a study by Gartner, mm-hmm. but they talk about the sales teams of the future are the ones that lead their customers through this process and make it, I say process because I'm Canadian, but mm-hmm. they make it easy. They make it easy for the customer when you're stuck. And exactly what you said, Sean, in the sea of sameness, I call it, where there's like a million solutions and a million messages, the way we survive is just by tuning everything out.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Would you say then that the salesperson's role has changed? Like, it sounds to me like, so what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said people trust the opinion of someone like them, which I love that idea. So it seems like, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, 10 years ago, it was all about selling, you know, first we started with product features, then we went to product benefits, right? And then now it sounds like we're going into
feelings.
I don't know, what would you say, the feelings?
Feelings.
Yeah,
100,000% feelings, right? Like, you know, one of the things I ask people is I say, let's say, now you guys look, you know, pretty healthy, but if I were to say, I want you to write down everything you ordered for lunch in the last month. Mm. And then I'm going to take that list and I'm going to show it to your doctor. And I'm going to ask your doctor, like, what percentage of the time did Sean and Jonathan order the best thing for that? And I say best, meaning calorically, food group, nutrition, like, what percentage of the time? I'm not asking you to out yourself, but maybe throw
it out. I mean, I've got jelly beans and beer on my desk at the moment. So I'm going with 10% for me, but Jonathan's a little more healthy than I am.
I would say 30. Let's go 35.
Okay. So the number is not a high number, regardless, you know, of whatever you pick. And so the reality is like, so here's the thing. Most of the time you do not order or make the best thing for you. Mm-hmm. But if I were to ask you, like, does that mean that you are upset? Like every day, you know, Sean, when you go for those jelly beans, you're like, oh man, I don't know why I'm doing this to myself. This is like the worst thing ever. Like, I'm willing to bet that you're probably fine and emotionally comfortable with the choices that you're making, even though they're not the most ideal and logical choices for you. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. Like even when you talk about like selling features and benefits and value, I love this talk of value because a lot of salespeople are conditioned to say, sell value, but value is a discretionary feeling because we've just established that you invest in things that are emotional, that you value, even though that there's no business value on the other side.
Right.
And so when people say sell value, what they really mean is like sell ROI, but ROI and feelings are not the same thing. So it's important to connect with customers emotionally and sell them the feeling. And the feeling could be like, it's what you believe and it's your conviction, right? And it's the enemy, for example, of the product that you're selling. Like if you have a product or solution, you have an enemy out there. Maybe it's wasted time, money, whatever it is. That's what you're selling. And when the customer buys your product or service, they're saying, I believe what you believe and that you will help me solve this problem. But what they're really buying, in addition to the actual ROI, is mm-hmm. the value of working with you, the feeling, right? The same way you order lunch. So that's the next, this is the frontier that, and it's always been that way. It's always been that way. I actually think if we had discovered this 20 years ago, we would have been in a much, but a lot of the research, you know, I say the modern approach to sales, because a lot of this research didn't exist 20 years ago that shows us how people actually buy.
Yeah. We say a lot on our show that people, and we borrowed this, I know, I can't remember from what book, but people buy based on emotion, but they justify it with logic. So they buy from an emotional standpoint, but then after they do it, you know, whether it's to your significant other or whoever is asking you the question, you try to make all sorts of logical, you bring up all these logical valid points as to why you made that choice. But in all reality, let's get real.
Yes. What's called post-purchase rationalization. It's like my wife, God bless my wife, she comes home and she's like, honey, I bought this coat. The great thing is it was on sale for 80% off and it was the last one of my size and the color goes with everything I have, you know? And if you were like the golf commentator, like off to the side, like commenting on what you're seeing, you're like, okay, David's wife just came home with a coat she doesn't need. And she's now explaining, you know, to make herself feel better that it made sense to buy this coat.
Exactly. Actually, David doesn't care.
Yeah, it's true. I don't care. But why is she saying these things? She's saying it to make herself feel better, right?
Right.
Because the way we as humans survive is by maintaining our level of like cognitive dissonance. Like we have to be and act in a way that's consistent with our stated beliefs and opinion. Yeah. So,
and she doesn't want to lose your trust or your liking of her. So regardless of her reason for buying, she needs to appease your reason that she might buy. Because otherwise she gets kicked out of the tribe on the street, you know, with no fire to keep her warm.
I'll tell you, you know, a lot of, you're not wrong. You know, a lot of, you know, kind of the way we interact with each other as humans goes back to like the tribe days, right? Where we're always trying to figure out, is this person a friend? How do we know if they're a friend? Even like empathy. We now know that there's hormones and chemicals that get released in the brain when people show kindness to us that tells our bodies that we can trust this other person.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's the goal of modern sellers is to do that, but it's very primitive the way we make decisions.
Yeah.
It's like a giant episode of Survivor all the time.
that's on more ways than one. You know, you got the quota, you got your customers, you got your boss breathing down your neck, sell some stuff. Why don't you?
So, yeah. So I've got a question. So you said people trust the opinion of someone like them. And I've said something similar from Dan Kennedy on the show where people want to be encouraged that their current worldview is correct more than they want to be educated to a new worldview or anything like that. So here's my question for you, David. If that's true, that people want to, that people trust the opinion of someone like them, how do you be like them ethically without like being a poser or, you know, just mirroring them for the sake of mirroring them just to get the sale? Like, how do you connect that authenticity and be like them when maybe you're not, but you still got a product to sell and they're a good customer and they're a good fit? Like, how do you cross that bridge?
So, I mean, there's a lot of nuance wrapped up in what you just said. But you know, one of the, I'll share this kind of story with you in tactic. One of the ways you get someone to move, and I say move in air quotes, it's, I love the Dan Pink term, like when you move someone from their viewpoint to yours, right? Mm-hmm. So oftentimes in sales, and especially in modern selling, where we have these, there's a million solutions on the market. We represent these very innovative things that we're bringing to our clients. And our clients have like 0% of their bandwidth dedicated to giving a crap about what we do, right? Right. So we actually do have to come in with a fair amount of conviction and enthusiasm mm-hmm. around the value and feelings that we add. But I can't oftentimes come in and just say, guys, you're doing this all wrong. You got to do this, right? And so, because that's very jarring to your world. Yeah. And so one of the tactics when you're trying to move someone from their position to yours is actually comfort them and make them feel like what they were doing was okay. I'll give you an example. So my third startup, which was acquired by Salesforce, what did we do? We were a feedback coaching and recognition platform. So I'm building up to this, right? It was this idea that at work, people wanted lots of feedback about, you know, how they were doing, lots of feedback and coaching, but the tool that people had traditionally used to give that information to them was called the annual performance review that most people use the word hate to describe.
Right.
So, you know, what we did was when we led with our messaging, and this is like the psychological kind of messaging tactic, one of the ones I teach, when someone said, well, what did you guys do? I don't say, oh, we were a platform for feedback and coaching. I said, you know what? One of the things that we believe, people want lots of feedback at work, and you know what they hate? Performance reviews. Mm. Right. And I'm not even talking about the product now. Now you're leaning in. You're like, oh, I might hate performance reviews too. Tell me more. But what we did was every now and then we would encounter like a more traditional, let's say HR or executive leader who would say, no, like performance reviews are good. Okay. And now we're like this. Yeah. I'm saying they suck and you're saying they're good. And there's no way that you can buy my product without feeling that you've somehow given up, right? Like you were wrong. And so one of the tactics that's actually stolen from one of my favorites. So I'm going to get it on the, I have multiple copies of this here. So I have lots of favorite sales books. This is one of my favorites. It's called Yes, 50 Scientifically Proven Ways to Be Persuaded. You got that there?
Yep. Yeah. It's on my shelf right back there.
Love this book.
Mine's over here somewhere. Yeah.
We got all. and the other one, I mean, I just happen to have it here, is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. I don't know if you've seen this. It's a thick read, but, so in the Yes book, one of the things they talk about is they say, look, if someone has a belief system, you have to cushion that belief. So what we would tell people is we would say, hey, you know what? Performance reviews, you're absolutely right. Like performance reviews were the gold standard for so many years. That was what people did. Mm-hmm. But they don't do that anymore as much because the advent of social media. And so what we're doing is we're saying, you're not wrong. You're just, you know, you were right, but you're not as right as you used to be because of these things. And I give you all sorts of reasons. So I'm building you a bridge to take you from where you were to where I want you to go. And so you feel like emotionally cushioned and supported in doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I mean, we do that all the time in copy. I've spent the last 10 years as a copywriter, you know, and if you can find a core belief that people agree with, and you know that that market agrees with that, you can then take them step by step just about anywhere you want to go. Cause like you said, you get them nodding their head yes on the first one, and just a little bit removed from that, they can be like, yeah, I can see that. And then another step. Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. And it's just that little bit of movement. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
Like with time in between, like give them time. Like, I'm, you know, especially in negotiations, sometimes when you're dropping, you know, a brick on someone, like, I need you to sit with that for a little bit and actually backing off and saying, hey, look, you know, I want you to think about this. If you're not into this, like we shouldn't move forward with each other. Right. And so I'm making it okay again for you to say no. And when I do that, you're more likely to kind of feel the pressures off and more likely to come back and say yes.
I think that is one of the most powerful things in all of sales is to give people outs more often.
Yeah.
And if you're not a confident salesperson, that freaks you out. Mm-hmm. But if you know you have the solution and you know, and if you don't have a scarcity mindset, you're not worried about any given customer being like the bread on the table that week, you know, that's a really powerful place to be. And like you said, I'm also a life coach. So giving people that space to kind of figure things out is really powerful. One of my favorite books on sales is called Instant Influence. Are you familiar with that one?
I'm not.
David? He's got six questions that are just so So the backstory on that is he's an ER doctor, and he would have to get drug addicts or people like that to change their behavior so they didn't keep coming into the ER. Mm-hmm. And he only had 7 minutes with any given patient to try to change their entire, you know, life. So he came up with like these six questions. I think it's six. I've got them. I use these on sales calls all the time. Yeah. Six questions that he goes through with people. And the last one is like totally open-ended. Like, so what do you want to do? Like he gives back the control to them to make the decision. And there's two or three other questions that are all very much like give them control.
When you give people control, the nice thing is if they kind of assume that control, now they're more committed.
Right.
So one of the best sales reps I ever worked with, she used to ask people at the end of the calls, instead of setting next steps, she said, what would you like to have as a next step?
Mm-hmm. See that's the final question in instant influence.
There you go. Maybe she's
read the literally book. It's like, what's the next step, if any?
Well, now the risk, it's funny because there's a counterpoint to that, because some people will say, well, I don't want to just ask the client what the next step should be. Because let's say, for example, they say, I want pricing, and you don't want to get pricing yet, right? You're not even there. So what do you do? But I actually do believe it's kind of like, it's funny, not to use an unnecessarily juvenile reference, but imagine how classroom rules are created in a kindergarten. So what happens? It's the first day of kindergarten. You get around and the teacher says, okay, class. So it's important that we have some rules for the classroom. Like, what do you think a good rule should be? Oh, we should share our toys. That's a good rule. Okay, let's write that down. And then they say, you know, oh, we should hit each other all the time. Well, I don't know about that, Sean. I know that's such a good rule. And so I don't write that down. So I do believe that there's a classroom management element to this, that if you ask someone, what do you want the good next step to be? And they say something good or better than what you were thinking, they're way more committed to it, which is awesome. And if they say something bad, you can still correct them. You still have an opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree with that. Go ahead, Jonathan.
No, I was going to ask, so you talk about telling compelling stories. Mm-hmm. So I'm just interested from your point of view as a sales professional, how do you go about telling, how do you go about telling a compelling story and integrating that into your sales process?
Yeah. So, you know, when we think about stories, we think about, you know, I'm watching Star Wars and there's this massive storyline and an arc and heroes and all this kind of stuff. The stories I think about, for me, like what a story is, it's a formulaic way of conveying your narrative, like a formulaic way. So one of my favorite formulas comes from one of my guilty pleasures, gentlemen, which is infomercial products.
Oh, nice.
I love infomercial products. I love how, like, here's the beauty, right? Like, you're watching, I don't even know if infomercials are on even so much anymore, but like, so.
Oh yeah, they're always on.
Okay, good. So you're sitting at home, it's like 2 a.m, you're doing nothing, and you're watching TV, and an infomercial comes on for a product that you don't need. And you're like, this is crap, I don't need it. And then like 2 seconds later, you're like, I need this in my life right now, right? So how do they do that, right? It's they tell a story very quickly in a formulaic way. So I talk about this in the book, I have it on my website as well, on my YouTube channel. But it's this idea of like, you kind of have a formulaic story where you say, like, here's the problem, here's the solution to the problem, here's why that ideal solution is actually hard. And then we insert our product. So I could say, hey, look, guys, so you want to get in the best shape of your life? Yeah, it's really easy. Just go to the gym and exercise, you know, for 3 hours a day for a week. Right. But the problem is gym memberships are expensive and hard to get to, but I have a solution. Now you don't even know.
P90X.
Well, you don't even know what the solution is. Right. But if you want to get in the best shape of your life and you agree that like the gym sucks and it's expensive and hard to get to and inconvenient, you're leaning in and you're saying, even just emotionally, like, tell me more. I want to hear what this next part is. Right.
Right.
And so when I talk about storytelling, it doesn't have to be, well, back in 1972 when we did, like, it doesn't have to be that. It can be a story that's told in 5 seconds that has an emotional arc that draws the person in. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. It's kind of, it reminds me of, as a writer, I love, the old 6-word stories. You know, there's the old idea that Hemingway told this 6-word story, and it was for sale, baby shoes never worn. And like, there's a whole story there, like heartbreak and all this stuff. And people often think that, you know, you have to draw out the stories to get the emotion and get all that stuff. And there's actually, I think there's a whole website on Six Word Stories. And it's amazing how quickly the infomercials, you know, especially when they get a hit and they have to condense it down to a 2-minute infomercial as opposed to a 30-minute, mm-hmm. and how they really nail down those things. It's mm-hmm. yeah, it's a work of art for sure.
Well, look, even cold calling, not that you're telling a whole narrative, but when you cold call someone, God bless the cold callers, you know, the customer, their main objective is get off the phone with you as quickly as possible. Sure. Your goal is keep them on the phone as long as possible. So like every word that you say is precious and important, right? So
yeah,
speed.
So yeah, that reminds me of the Wolf of Wall Street, right? when he was trying to get people, you got to hook them like right away, but it's got to be to their benefit and to their worldview and what mm-hmm. they're already looking for. And that's how you get them.
Absolutely.
Well, look, not get them as a bad thing. Like
hook them in. Yeah. Well, look, as a copywriter, you know this better than anyone, right? Like the first line's got to make them read the second line and so on right after that. You know, you don't have the luxury of someone like if I'm training a customer and I'm with them for 3 hours, they have to listen to everything I have to say, right? So right. I don't have to, I try to hook them early, but it's not a requirement the same way it is when you're doing copy or, you know,
or Facebook ad or, yeah. you know,
absolutely
all that. Jonathan, you were going to ask a question?
Yeah. So let's talk about the times we're in because it's kind of interesting. These are weird, crazy times. So how do you go about, you know, and I'm sure this is part of your book where you cover, you know, having empathy. How do you go about, like, you know, from a standpoint of understanding the customer during times where we're like in the middle of a crisis or a pandemic, as some would say, mm-hmm. You know, is it business as usual or do you have to really take in, you know, what's going on around you and really understand and use that when you're talking to your customers? I know from my standpoint, when I've reached out to a lot of my clients over the last 2 weeks, everything, all of my language incorporates what's going on because I understand from my clients, they're hurting right now. Some of these are manufacturing customers that are being forced to shut down. They're having to shut down for a period of time. Some of them are suffering with supply chain problems. You know, there's all sorts of issues. So the message that I have been conveying over the last couple of weeks is let me know how I can help you. You know, let me know how I can help you, how I can bring some technical assistance to you. And I'm not asking you for anything else. Just call me, reach out to me if you need any help, because I know that things are tough right now for you guys.
Absolutely. I think, you know, everyone is impacted by this in the same way, but also differently. Yeah. Like, you know, depending on, you know, if you're in, you know, in the restaurant industry or the cruise sure. industry or true, like you're going to be harder hit than if you're like, let's say in IT security or, mm-hmm. and then manufacturing. Well, it depends. Like, what are you manufacturing? If you're manufacturing restaurant equipment, then yes, you're hurting. But it's really important to actually understand at a very nuanced level, like your customer mm-hmm. and what industry they're in. So when you reach out and look, there's nothing wrong reaching out and saying, hey, look, I'm here. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have a long-term relationship, they're already a customer of yours.
Yeah.
Right. And you're like, hey, look, let me know how I can help. The other thing is like a lot of organizations still have to sell. So yeah. they're trying to figure out like, how do I continue to,
right.
let's say prospect and you know, drum up new business in this kind of environment. And my advice, in addition to like the empathetic component and tone that you have to reach out with, which you've identified, it's also like being very focused about who you're reaching out to. Like, I'm sure. not going to reach out to people in the restaurant industry and saying, hey, I know times are tough, but now's never been a better time to do like,
it's a great time to buy.
Yeah. You know, so I want you to demonstrate that you've done some research into mm-hmm. my business and already have a point of view about how you can help. You should do that at the best of times.
Right.
But especially now, coming in with a point of view about how you can help, because for some customers, they may not realize some of the ways in which you can help. Mm-hmm. But that's the first step, figuring yeah. out who you
can. Absolutely. And that's an awesome point, because the other point of that outside of the empathy that I was just showing is letting, not directly, but indirectly letting some of the customers that I've worked with in the past who have purchased Their supplies or products from overseas, understanding what, how the pandemic has interrupted a lot of supply chains, knowing, letting them know that if you do have supply chains, if they haven't purchased from me in the past, letting them know if they currently have a supply chain problems, you know, or a supply chain problem, I can be there to help, you know? And so that's answering a question. If they're not currently a customer, letting them know that we can help them if they're interrupt, because a lot of them are experiencing that with what's going on in Europe and overseas. And so you're absolutely right. There's opportunity. You just have to spend a little time doing a little bit of research. And that's certainly something that if you spend a little time understanding what their problems can be regarding everything that's going on right now, you can certainly understand, you know, if they're having problems, you need to offer a solution because that's what they're looking for.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the solutions, cost savings, yep, deferrals, whatever it is. And I look, you know, to a lot of corporations' credits, you're seeing like a lot of really good reactions happening now. Like never before have you ever seen this, like governments and private industry all kind of banding together to be like, hey, look, whatever it takes, mm-hmm, because maybe for the first time ever, we have this very deep shared sense of empathy. Certainly, you know, in the times of the world wars, there was that sense, but this is like super fast, super immediate, super consistent. And so in a way it's tough now, tough sledding for a lot of sellers, but sure, in a way it's like it's like an inflection point. There's a lot of trial by fire. There's a lot of learning that's happening for, yeah, everyone in the same boat. And I feel like at the end of the day, we're going to come out better on the, yeah, other side of this.
You know, yeah, I've heard a lot of comparisons to like World War and, you know, companies stepping up to offer, to switch their manufacturing lines, their tooling to create the products they need, like toilet paper, like, you know, like all kinds of stuff. But I think the difference here is like, we're all, the entire world is fighting the same enemy, so to speak, as opposed to being divided in half, mm-hmm, where it was Axis and allies or whatever. Now the whole world is fighting the same enemy. So they're all kind of on the same page. And of course we have technology that can allow us to communicate faster, easier. Yeah. You know, I can't imagine like dealing with this, going back to the Spanish flu, mm-hmm, in 1918, when your source of information was either word of mouth or newspapers.
Yeah.
And how much more quickly now, you know, with radio, TV and internet, like how much more quickly we can get the message out to stay home or to, whatever, whether you agree with it or not, like it offers some pretty cool opportunities to help your customers, to help each other, all that kind of stuff. Yep. It's pretty cool. And if you can sit back objectively and realize that this is just temporary and it's always hard. I know in your book, you talk about cognitive biases, David, like it's really hard when you're in the moment to kind of have perspective, but like this is, you know, it's just another thing. You know, nobody thought we'd survive the financial crisis in 2008. We all came out fine. We had the longest economic expansion in history after that. Like it's people forget that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's pretty cool. I want to real quick, we're running short on time, but I want to just read, I pulled up your book on Amazon, David. And as a copywriter, like I really respect the way you did your table of contents. I don't know if you did that or somebody else did that. But I think our listeners would really appreciate some of the things that are in there. So I'm going to tease and then I'll let you tell people where they can find more about you and your book and things like that. So I'm just going to read some of the subtitles within the chapters.
Yeah.
Like the Cobra Kai paradox. I love that one. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's
great copy. Especially for kind of our age group. Let's see, the number one question, the one question to never ask your customer.
Oh yeah.
But these are like clickbait worthy titles here. You've done a good job on your table of contents.
Yeah.
The attention value matrix. Let's look at some other ones. A magical question in chapter 3. Forget everything you know about value. We kind of touched on that a little bit.
Yeah.
So in chapter 3, the trouble at the happiest place on earth. That's kind of interesting. I got to find out more about that.
Yeah.
A deceptively difficult question in chapter 5, excuse me.
Yeah.
Road testing your message. I mean, you've got some great like subtitles here in your different chapters, and I see a lot of people don't use their table of contents as well as they could. And I've written a couple of table of contents for friends and things like that, and pack book covers. I just got to say, there's some really good teasers, because I think that's how people buy books these days on Amazon, is they look inside and then look at the table of contents, and you've got some great, really cool ideas. Like, I will definitely be buying the book when we're done with the call here.
Right on. Yeah, it's funny. So yeah, all of the table of contents is all my stuff. The initial thinking when I had the book, so I've been writing like articles and blog posts and been doing the YouTube channel for a number of years. So I had all this content, and I figure, oh, this should be easy. I'll just take all these articles and smush them together in like a book, and like, boom, like book.
Easy.
And so that did not happen. Because when you think about a blog post has a beginning, middle, end, and it's like a little, it's all wrapped up, right?
Right.
When you write a book, sure, the middle part of that blog post is useful, but like the chapter is this long, so you can't just conclude it.
Right.
So a lot of the table, and it's funny, I got the book here, so I'm looking through the table of contents just to remind myself.
Oh, hold that thing up. That thing's pretty thick.
Yeah, the book is 270 pages.
Nice.
So it's no pamphlets. I will tell you this. It's 6x9. It turned out to be, people do judge books by covers. We went through multiple cover iterations to land on this bad boy. Mm-hmm. But the table of contents, it's funny. Like what I did was I just wrote the book.
Yeah.
And then the table of contents was just whatever it was after I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you start seeing the headings and you start like, you know, I use the power of too many times, like the power of this, the power of that. So I'm like, okay, I got to like tone down the power. But I tried to make headings that were consistent with some of my blog posts, which, you know, which is why the headings are kind of, you know, a little bit more intriguing. Also, it's funny when we did the book, the first iteration of the table of contents was just the chapter headings. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what though, like oftentimes I'm going to want to refer my buddies here, Sean and Jonathan, to like, I want you to go read the paradox of ROI. I want you to go read that section, and I want you to be able to find it quickly. So they said, absolutely, makes sense. And so they completely fleshed out the table of contents. So it's a 3-page table of contents. It's pretty detailed. Some of the subheadings actually span a couple lines. They're so long. But yeah, it's good to be able to create intrigue, but also refer people. Like, oh, go read the Cobra Kai, you know, subheading, and people know what I'm
talking about. Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's like, it's almost like a whole set of fascination bullets. Like if you're reading a really good sales letter, you know, where it says, it has like a fascination bullet and then it has the page number so that when you order the book and get the book, I mean, that's what the table of contents feels like. So I think that's great. So for our listeners, like just reading the table of contents is a great look at a way to persuade people. But the title of the book is Sell the Way You Buy, A Modern Approach to Sales That Actually Works Even on You. So like you've got the whole even if statement, you've got like, you did a really good job with this, David, on the whole book. So I'm excited to get this book for myself and dive into it. And man, we've been talking for an hour already. So, and I'm almost out of beer and I have to pee. So
that's
all right, David. So, you know, that means time is short. So I got two real, really quick questions before we wrap up. Okay. Favorite all-time sales movie.
Oh my gosh. Tommy Boy.
Tommy. Oh, ooh,
wow.
Interesting.
That's a good one. I like that.
You make me want to check, because I've watched it, but it's been a long time, so I got to go back and...
Oh, no, it's great. I'll tell you, my objection handling training session that I do, I have a lot of video clips, like a lot of movies, because there's a lot of good content, right, that we can borrow from movies, and I have a couple clips from Tommy Boy.
Okay.
As it relates to objection handling.
So I'm curious why that's your favorite. I think I know, but I'm curious.
I think, you know, so here's why. One of the things that I don't know, you let the tiger out of the cage. One of the things that I'm a big fan of is this concept, and I talk about it in the book, it's called unconscious selling. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by unconscious selling? It means like there's a lot of people who sell stuff, and some of them are really great and some of them are really crappy. And whether they're good or bad, whatever tactics they use, they actually don't know why those tactics are good or bad. Like, right. I just do these. And like, so for example, you might have an unconsciously good seller, like a personal trainer or hairdresser, who's really great at what they do and it'd be very persuasive, but they don't know why. Like, it's just, you know, it's just part of them. Right. And so the idea is to go from an unconscious seller to a conscious seller, where once I tell you this tactics that you're using that are so good, you're going to start doing them more consistently and doubling down. And by the same token, if you're an unconsciously bad seller and I start telling you like, here's why what you're doing isn't working, I'll be like, oh crap. And you'll fix it. So why do I like Tommy Boy? Cause it tells the story of this guy who's like this unconsciously good seller, right? Like in his personal life, he can sell, but when he gets in front of a customer, he puts on this like different persona. Mm-hmm. And the moral of the story is just like, just know why what you're doing is so good,
right?
And do more of that. So that's
yeah. Okay. Really, and when you seem like when the switch flips for him, and he just gets into his heart, and selling from his heart, like he sells everybody,
right?
But when he's trying to sell, he can't sell crap.
that's exactly it. And all too often in the sales profession, it's almost like we walk around with sales badges like the FBI, and we're like, excuse me, sir, I'm going to treat you like a jerk for the next half hour. It's okay. I'm in sales. It's allowed. Like, no, it's not allowed. Right. And so that's the transition we need to make.
So all right. Second question.
I am totally intrigued by the drawing behind you.
I was going to ask that too. So.
It's funny. So a lot of people are intrigued by that drawing, so much so that I have a video on my YouTube channel that I released on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 2018. So if you go to my YouTube channel, there's a video with a picture of me and the thumbnail is me doing this. Uh-huh. And it's, what's that thing on the wall? That's okay. The name of the title. So what that is.
Nice tease.
So what is the YouTube channel?
Cerebral Selling. So okay. If you just go into YouTube and search for Cerebral Selling, you'll find the YouTube channel. But so what that is a flip chart, you know, people do flip charts, like give a talk. That is a flip chart illustration from Simon Sinek. You guys know Simon Sinek?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm a big Simon Sinek fan. In 2016, I spoke at a conference that Simon Sinek also spoke at, and he gave a talk. Actually, he wrote this, where I have it here. He wrote this book called The Infinite Game. This is his brand new book. And in 2016, he was backstage about to give a talk at this conference on like Start With Why Are Leaders You Last or something like that. And he was backstage with Seth Godin, and he's bouncing around this idea of the infinite game. And he said, you know, Seth, I've been talking about this infinite game thing. It's all about doing what you love and are passionate about and like having this mindset. And Seth's like, you should go out there right now and like give the talk. And he's like, so he convinced Simon to go out and just crap what he was doing and do this infinite game talk. And it killed. And this flip chart was what he used on stage to give the talk. And so the organizers of the conference knew I was a big Simon fan. And so I got to meet him afterwards and awesome. I took him, I brought the flip chart and he signed it in the middle.
Very cool. Yeah.
So I framed it. This is an infinite game talk. I framed it to remind me that like why I do what I do. I do what I do, not because I'm trying to win or because I'm trying to make the most money. I love sales. I want people to do it the right way because this is my chosen profession.
Yeah.
And that's
just cause
to crack.
That's it.
Yep.
That's the mission.
Yeah. I just finished that book on Audible and it is fantastic.
Yes.
I love Simon Sinek stuff. So yeah, that's cool.
All right, David. Well, we've gone long enough. I want to, before we cut out here, how can people get a copy? What's the best place outside of Amazon people can find a copy of your book?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's going to be available everywhere you buy books. So it'll be, you know, if you Barnes and Noble, if you're in Canada on Indigo, it's going to be like you can buy the electronic version on Amazon or Apple Books. Like anywhere you buy your electronic copies, you can get it. Yeah. So yeah, it should be, you know, once we get to go back to stores again, you should be able to find it there, but, online at Amazon. And if you want to learn more about, you know, I actually give a lot of my content away for free.
Sure.
I shouldn't say that now that I have a book for sale, but if you want lots of free content, go to cerebralselling.com. You can find out that I have my blog there. It links to my YouTube channel, which you can find in Cerebral Selling. There's a link to the book on the website as well, and lots of content I give away all for free. So check it out.
Well, I've already pre-ordered my copy, so I can't wait till Tuesday to get this and start digging in. This is a good time to do so when things are a little bit slower out there. Absolutely. This is a good time to start digging into some of these books, and I can't wait. Again, it's Sell, The Way You Buy, A Modern Approach to Sales That Actually Works. And David, we'll be posting a link on our show page, man. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. This is definitely one of the most fun podcasts I've been on. We get to drink beer and just awesome. Chat around. So thanks for having me. Pleasure.
Yep. Listen, have a great weekend. We'll be posting this Monday right before your book comes out. So this will be good timing. Nice. And I'll be sending you over a link. So thanks so much, man. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys. You too. Take care.
Take care, man. See you. Bye. Yeah, that was fun. Yeah. Good stuff. Hey, I know you've got to make an exit here.
Yeah, I got to pee.
So we'll wrap it up quick. Hey, guys, thanks everyone for listening. It's been fun. As always, you can find us Persuasion by the Pint. Sean, I guess we'll see everybody next week. Take care.